attitude. We are going to energise the country.
Stop Brexit.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Seamus, I'm not sure this is a great idea either.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by our first returning guest. He's an activist for the Labour Party and for our future's sake. It's Nathan Baroda. Welcome back to the podcast, Nathan.
Thank you very much, Will. Glad to be back.
So, first of all, I'd like to ask, I know you've been canvassing in, campaigning in Warwick and Leamington. And obviously, previously, this has been, before the last election, a seat held by the Conservatives. Do you have a feeling whether there is much desire for it to return to the Conservatives, or would you say that the support for the Labour Party is still quite strong in the constituency?
It's an interesting question, because I think the answer is that the support against the Conservatives is quite large. You know, around 60-65% in my head are anti-Conservative, and that manifested with a number of conversations I had on the doorstep. But it's just about the way that the Remain vote splits. There is certainly a solid majority for, obviously, you know, party policy goes beyond on Brexit, absolutely. But for Remain party, there is a solid majority. But actually, the way that the Liberal Democrats have been so active in Warwick and Leamington, it's their number one target seat in the West Midlands, means that we are at risk of splitting the vote and letting the Tories back in, despite there not being at all any enthusiasm for them beside a sort of rump of 35%.
And of course, some people have been concerned over the date of the election, because of course, one of the strong parts of the Labour majority in Warwick and Leamington is based around students. And of course, a lot of students will be going home and might not necessarily be voting in the election in the constituency. Do you worry that this will have a potential impact on the result?
Absolutely. I mean, Warwick and Leamington had an unbelievable swing of over 10% in 2017. And a lot of that was from students, but not all of it. You know, a different batch of students has, a totally new batch of students has come in since the 2017 election. Look, we need to sign as many people up to postal votes as possible. But also, you know, bear in mind that the academics who disproportionately do vote for Labour will still be around. Some students will still be around as well. And also, you know, we do need to have the safety net of winning outside of students as well, just to be sure that, you know, so we need to win in the Warwick area and parts of, you know, North Leamington and Whitnash, etc., where students don't live, just to be sure of a majority anyway.
Now, what's been happening today, a great deal in political discussion, has been discussions over health policy. Now, the Labour Party has been discussing its health policy today, and one of the elements that has come up as potentially occurring under a Labour government would be freedom of movement remaining in place for people who wish to work in the NHS. Now, how do you think this is going to go over for voters? Because, of course, there will be some people who might argue that any form of freedom of movement would be a betrayal of the vote for Brexit, etc. How would you, what would you say to that?
Sure. So just to answer firstly the question of betrayal, it's an interesting point. I mean, obviously, I think the coarsening of political language and the way that Theresa May used, you know, the months and year after the referendum to sort of make it into a culture war was certainly unhelpful. It's worth considering that 48% of the country obviously voted Remain, but a decent minority of Leave voters voted to have a close economic relationship, and obviously that included free movement. All it needs is for there to be 4% of Leave voters, but I'm sure there is, I'm sure there's a little bit more than that, who support the continuation of free movement, for there to actually be a majority. So I guess it isn't necessarily a betrayal of the people's will, even if it is against what people voted for with Brexit. But the point is, I mean, you speak to a good point, which is that Remainers or anyone who wants us to stay in the single market and, you know, maintain any level of close economic relationship needs to win the argument for free movement. We can't keep skirting around it. We can't keep, you know, Stephen Kinnock style throwing Article 112 of, you know, ending free movement within the single market. It's just not going to happen. And I also don't believe that we should be supporting, you know, restricting rights of Labour, but not of capital. I think that's absurd. So look, we need to make the case for free movement. I mean, to make the case that migrants disproportionately give money to the system and obviously have a cultural value, a social value. You know, we welcome people from all backgrounds. That's fantastic. But people respond to incentives and the economy, and that migrants, immigrants disproportionately give money back, take money, you know, pay more taxes than take out in services. So we need to make that case and stop being afraid to make that case. I think that's where Ed Miliband failed in 2015, was he failed to make a positive case for immigration. I think that's what we need to do, based on culture, based on economic realities and incentives. And actually, I think people will respond far better to that.
Another point that's also been raised in the discussions about Labour's plans for healthcare has been whether a four-day week would be allowed for staff in the NHS, whether they would want it or whether it would pose all this sort of thing. Do you think that a four-day week would be helpful to the health service? And if it did happen, do you think it would have a negative or a positive effect on the health service?
So I think undoubtedly it would have a positive effect. Obviously, we need to recruit far more staff for the NHS, but the current staff, particularly junior doctors, are massively overworked and overstretched. And in turn, that has a detrimental effect to the services that they provide, and therefore the health that we have. So the question is actually recruiting more people, which isn't easy by any means. You know, from a non-party political perspective, it's not easy to recruit people. It's a long process, but we need to do that. Look, I think there's a lot of scaremongering about a four-day week. I mean, maybe it's better to rebrand it as a three-day weekend. But it's likely going to be a second-term policy. So even in a five, you know, if there was a Labour majority in a five-year fixed-term Parliaments Act, it's going to take a very long time to implement. And whilst I'm very, very supportive of the policy, those who are sceptical shouldn't worry about it in the next Parliament.
It's interesting also to note that there have been comparisons in terms of Labour's proposals for increases of spending on the NHS per year in terms of percent with what the Blair and Brown governments achieved in terms of percent. Do you think that this is a wise comparison to make, or do you think that it's a bit unfair to compare what a government that may have to rely on the support of other parties to get legislation through would be able to achieve this to compare to the majority governments that obviously we saw under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown?
So I hadn't seen that comparison, but yeah, I suppose it is fair in that, you know, the party we'd likely be going into coalition with, the SNP, Plaid, the Greens, etc., perhaps, you know, if worst comes to worst, the Liberal Democrats do, we'll broadly be supportive of that. So I think we should feel comfortable making that pledge, perhaps in the terms, I mean, the policy that Blair and Brown had, which was raising national insurance contributions to fund it, was absolutely excellent. Led to a great improvement in health outcomes in our country. I think we should actually promise to some extent the £350 million a week. I mean, it resonated so well during the referendum. It's a figure that sort of balances sounding quite large, but also sounding, you know, you can sort of put a metric to it in a way you can't with this 1.2 trillion nonsense. Ultimately, though, I actually think the point that he's making is the money we give to the NHS is crucial, but it can't be done in isolation. And there has to be a far greater synergy with particularly social care, but also, you know, mental health services, homelessness, etc. It has to be seen in the round. And I think, of course, Labour has won the argument, and the Tories' rhetoric on that since Johnson has come in reflects that. You know, over a number of years, we've won the argument, but we need to see it far more holistically than we are now.
One of the other points that has recently come up and has been quite prominent in the news has been how the government has been dealing with flooding in Yorkshire and the Midlands. How do you think a Labour government would deal with natural emergencies like this, where people have been flooded out of their homes and, you know, dams have burst and all this sort of thing, differently from the way that the Conservatives are currently dealing with it?
Sure. So I actually come from Bury, a place in Greater Manchester, which had very bad floods in 2015 after on the Boxing Day. And you know, I know the consequences of what can happen. Look, it has to be about funding for the Environment Agency and getting flood protections. That's absolutely crucial. And there is a clear link, actually, between austerity, cuts to the Environment Agency, and flooding, inevitably so. But also, to take this to a wider holistic point, it's got to be about the environment too. These are disproportionately occurring because of climate change, because of man-made climate change. And Labour's policy for a Green New Deal is superb. I was proud to have played an albeit small part in trying to deliver that at a Labour conference. But, you know, it's changes to the environment that are fundamental, and flood defences should absolutely be a part of Labour's Green New Deal.
Mm. Do you think that, as you were talking about a holistic approach, do you think that the problem is not necessarily just in terms of funding for flood defences, but also we've seen obviously a lot of houses that have been flooded because they were built on floodplains. Do you think that Labour should review the practice in terms of house building, whether people can build houses on floodplains, and if they are able to build them on floodplains, what particular restrictions they might have to adhere to?
Sure. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me that housing should take place on floodplains. You've got plenty of places, particularly brownfield sites, urban areas, and other areas which aren't floodplains that we could build on. It doesn't sound very common sense to me.
Mm. Now, something that you mentioned earlier is about the pressure of the Remain vote in Warwick and Leamington. And of course, we've seen the formation of a Remain alliance between the Liberal Democrats, the Greens, and other parties. Do you think that this would be an alliance that Labour should have considered going into, or do you think it was right that Labour didn't consider going into some sort of electoral pact with those other parties?
So, quite controversially for my party, I'm a big fan of tactical voting and also electoral pacts. Now, we have loads of disagreements with the Liberal Democrats, you know, their time in coalition being symptomatic of that, but their general policies of you know, capitalism and partly neoliberalism. I mean, Swinson sometimes sounds like she's to the right of Boris Johnson on the economy. We have profound disagreements with them, but look, ultimately our opponents are the Conservatives. So they're the rivals who are going to form the next government. Now, we need to say, look, in the vast majority of seats, in 90% of seats, we're a national party. Labour should stand. But bear in mind, we don't stand in Northern Ireland already for very sensitive particular reasons. But we've already made an exception there. So, you know, I don't want to pop people off from standing in positions where we're not close. So take Southport, for example. Mm-hmm. We came from third last time to a very close second and could possibly win it this time, similar to Chipping Barnet, where we came from nowhere. But if there are seats like, you know, in the southwest, Richmond is the one that really annoys me because we could have stopped Zach Goldsmith from getting re-elected. Mm. You know, the Lib Dems and Tories are getting 45% each. There is no chance we're going to win it. We should be far more pragmatic in that. In a handful of seats, in 5 or 10 seats, particularly in the southwest, South London, where the Tories could gain it, particularly the gains they made in 2015, perhaps have been reversed now, or perhaps Tories hold with a small majority of the Liberal Democrats, we should stand down. We should reluctantly, because we want Labour MPs rather than Lib Dem MPs, but the priority is stopping Tory MPs. Equally, the Liberal Democrats should be doing the same thing. Obviously, Canterbury is sort of emblematic of that because of the fantastic MP Rosie Duffield there and the tightness of the majority. But also, you know, think about in seats like Nuneaton, which would be decisive to stopping Boris Johnson from getting a majority, is there is no reason for the Liberal Democrats to stand there. They are so far behind, and the only way of stopping a Tory MP getting re-elected is by them standing down and backing Labour. So it is frustrating. I know it's not popular because, look, we're a party, we're a family, we don't want to extend that to people we disagree with. But if the cost of that is allowing the Tories to get back in, it, you know, to win a single seat, it's worth doing. Because they do so much damage to our country, as do the Lib Dems, but they do comparatively more, and we need to stop them. So, as I said, I know it's not popular, but I think we need to be a bit more sensible when it comes to electoral pacts.
Mm. Now, one thing that has perhaps strained relations between the Labour Party in the rest of the United Kingdom and the Labour Party in Scotland has been the implication or perhaps suggestion that Labour would go into government with the SNP if they win more seats in Scotland, or even if they retain the seats in Scotland. How much do you think that undermines Scottish Labour, or do you think that it's just a reasonable assumption to make?
I think it's reasonable. I have a lot of respect for Scottish Labour. Richard Dennett is a great leader. But I actually do think we should give them far more autonomy and just allow Scottish Labour to basically be an autonomous organisation within itself. And sort of the Labour Party becomes, takes sort of the Green Party model of becoming the Labour Party of England and Wales. It would still be the same party, but we would stand in English and Welsh seats. Obviously, aside from a few exceptions, as I've mentioned. But look, I don't like the SNP. I don't think they've governed Scotland well. I think they've imposed austerity, particularly on Scottish local councils. And I do personally disagree with the Scottish independence. But, you know, if it's a chance of getting the Tories out and getting a government that we lead, 100%, I wouldn't think twice about it. I understand why Scottish Labour would be angry with that. But, look, if it was a hung parliament, our options are quite limited. And I'm sure they, you know, Scottish Labour would rightly be far more annoyed if Boris Johnson got re-elected. So I see where they're coming from, but I'd happily go into coalition with the Lib Dems despite some disagreements. But the SNP, though.
Now, you mentioned the possibility of a hung parliament, and of course there is the possibility that Boris Johnson might win this election and the Conservatives might have a majority. Do you think that it would be appropriate in that circumstance for Jeremy Corbyn to resign as leader of the Labour Party?
Look, it depends on that election result. If Boris Johnson gets a majority of 1 to 10, you know, Jeremy has the mandate from the members twice. And look, if he wanted to stay on, I would be comfortable with that. But I think after having lost, he ran very tight last time but eventually didn't get into government. If we weren't to win this time, despite the chaos that the Conservatives have been done for the past 2.5 years, but also for the past 10, I can't see Jeremy staying.
Now, an election that is certain to happen at some point relatively soon is the election of the deputy leader of the Labour Party. And we've had some names coming out recently. Who do you think of any particular politician in the Labour Party, whether they be the people that have suggested that they would be likely to run or not, who do you think would be the best deputy leader of the Labour Party?
So it's an interesting question because it basically depends on whether or not there's a change to leadership, because it's a bit like you don't want to use your top Trump in a deputy leadership if you get what I'm saying. So what I'd quite like to see in one form or another is Angela Rayner and Rebecca Long-Bailey take over the leadership of the party. So whether I'd be on fuss as to whether one would be leader or deputy leader. If one were to be leader and the other to be Shadow Chancellor, that would be fine. Dawn Butler is also an excellent choice. I think it's really important that we have women leading our party. I think it's embarrassing right now that we haven't had a woman leader. But particularly, I'd like to see Angela Rayner and Rebecca Long-Bailey in positions of power. You know, strong, Greater Manchester women who would challenge Boris Johnson robustly and I think will absolutely, definitely lead us to a majority.
One thing you mentioned there is that you'd obviously like to see women at the forefront of the Labour Party. Now, one of the proposed compromises going back a couple of months was the idea of having two deputy leaders, a male candidate and a female candidate. And some people suggested that might be somewhat tokenistic. What do you feel about that?
No, I'd feel absolutely comfortable with it. Having reserved places for women is really important because disproportionately when they're not, they are filled by men. So it only really affects mediocre men who aren't going to get, who could only win in certain circumstances. So no, I absolutely think that we should be promoting women in leadership, and if that requires reserve places, we should absolutely be in favour of that. If we get to a stage where it's happening automatically, then fine, but I'm absolutely comfortable with it as it is.
Now, one of the other great concerns of the election, one that has been brought up recently when Jeremy Corbyn was in Glasgow and he was accused of being a terrorist sympathiser by a Scottish Church of Scotland minister, is defence. How do you think Labour will be able to convince people to support them who may have concerns about Labour's defence policy or maybe have concerns about Jeremy Corbyn and whether, as some may suggest, he may be a risk to national security? How do you think Labour can convince those people to vote for them?
Sure. So two things, and there are two things that are fundamental to Jeremy Corbyn's politics. Is firstly, anti-colonialism. Is his critique of Western foreign policy is actually quite in keeping with the vast ways of the public. And we saw that in the wake of the Manchester attack. So I think that's absolutely something that, you know, we should be a firmly anti-colonial party and that should guide our foreign policy. I think in terms of obviously foreign policy and defence are intertwined. And secondly, another part of Jeremy's politics and part of the party that he's transformed now is about being anti-austerity. Now, the way that veterans are treated in the country, you know, increased homelessness is an absolute disgrace. And that's because of austerity. You know, the way that cuts to wider defence organisations, whether, you know, you agree with them or not, you know, the cuts aren't being made out of opposition to, you know, to colonialism or imperialism. They're made because of austerity. So if we have defence organisations that we want to keep, I can't think off the top of my head, I know the MOD's been cut quite decisively, if we want to keep parts of that, then, you know, let's fund it properly. Let's not do what the Conservatives have been doing, which is talking the talk on saying Corbyn's a risk for security, whilst also cutting the police, cutting the army, and, you know, taking us on unnecessary wars around the world.
Now, obviously, another point regarding foreign policy that will be quite important during this election will be whoever of the two main parties wins, with making the presumption it will be the two main parties, but I think it's a fair one. They will obviously be going forward with a policy for Britain to maybe leave the European Union or perhaps stay, given Labour's policy. But if we do see a Labour government with Brexit at the same time, the Labour Party will be facing making deals with other countries like the United States of America. How do you think a Corbyn-led government would deal with any sort of like trade negotiations with the United States?
So I'm actually not sure that situation will occur because obviously, you know, Labour Party policy is for a people's vote, but also the choices on that would be between Remain, obviously, in which that wouldn't happen, but between the alternative would be a softer Brexit, which would involve a customs union. So actually, I'm actually not convinced that there would be any third-party trade negotiations. Obviously, the implication of that soft Brexit deal winning is that there would be negotiations with the EU eventually, you know, particularly focused on the future partnership. So I'm not convinced that would be particularly an issue in the next parliament.
How do you think the relations between, leaving aside trade negotiations, how do you think the relationships between President Trump and Prime Minister Corbyn would go? How do you think the special relationship would work with those two quite polar opposite figures representing their respective countries?
Well, hopefully it will only last for about 13 months until Trump is decisively beaten by Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. Look, you know, for those remaining 30 months, I would, you know, I know this sounds different to the sort of rhetoric you get, but I quite hope it was hostile. I don't think that we should be, you know, pandering to Donald Trump in the way that the Theresa May did, Johnson has, and Macron has as well. Like, we should be robustly challenging for what he does. And the special relationship is, you know, I think it's a naive foreign policy. I don't think they're that bothered about the UK anymore. But they might have been, you know, there's a sentimental reason, obviously, and perhaps more of a, you know, close links in the Cold War. But I'm not convinced that America are leading us on in that way. What I would like to see, though, is if particularly Sanders, but also Warren, were to be elected, to have that great consensus between, you know, socialist leaders on either side of the Atlantic leading the way about how to, you know, challenge the economic order. I think that would be, that could build a new special relationship, and that would be one that I would, that would absolutely love to see.
If we did see a President Warren or a President Sanders, how do you think the shared values that a Prime Minister Corbyn and a President Sanders and a, or a President Warren would have, would influence the rest of the world? Do you think we would be seeing more of a more socialist parties coming to power in the rest of Europe and the rest of the world? Do you think we would see a softening of approach to perhaps some certain conflicts in the Middle East, where America and Britain in the past have been a bit more aggressive? How do you think the world would change with those leaders?
So I think I separate the two back into conflicts and the economy. I think absolutely there would be a scaling down of conflicts, because America has been the decisive actor in propagating those, you know, thinking Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. So I think that would absolutely scale down, and countries like France, obviously, who were far more sceptical about Iraq, and Germany and other leading, you know, people, particularly on the Security Council, would be far more sceptical about going to war, because there isn't that American backing if Warren or Sanders was to be in charge. In terms of the economy and how that would impact the rest of the world, it's a far more interesting question. I'm not sure if there would be an effect outside an election. So say, you know, whereas Macron might say, we're not going to go to war in whichever country next, because President Warren has said we're not, I think he'd be far less likely to say, let's, you know, nationalise this. And obviously France has quite a lot of nationalised industries, but let's nationalise this because Elizabeth Warren has done it. Where it could have an impact, though, is by setting an example and by, you know, showing to the public in other nations, this is what happens when the economy is owned by people rather than, you know, motivated by people rather than profit. And really showcase a new economic model. And it's an interesting point, because neoliberalism was inaugurated by, you know, it's a bit of a sweeping statement, but the two countries that are far most associated with it are, you know, were Reagan's USA and Thatcher's UK. Now, if there was to be a new economic model that transformed along the lines I've talked about, that ended neoliberalism, replaced it with something far more equitable, you know, and that was to be led by Prime Minister Corbyn or another Labour leader, and a US President like Sanders or Warren, then I think that would set an example to try and create that hegemony for other countries. But obviously they have democratic processes, and if that was to be rejected, that's to be rejected. It's about proving that it works and trying to challenge that established conventional wisdom that there is no alternative to neoliberalism.
We've recently had a general election in Spain, and I just wondered what your thoughts were on the new coalition between Pedro Sanchez and Podemos. How do you feel about that? Do you think this is a step forward in the right direction for Spain?
Sure. I mean, Podemos are an anti-austerity party. I have to be honest with you, I don't follow Spanish politics too closely, but I'm aware that Podemos, they are good, right?
Yeah.
I think that I'm not gonna pretend I know everything about Spanish politics at all. But look, the point is, we were looking at in 2015, 2016, although it's probably starting a little bit earlier, and with the European Parliament elections of 14, is the rise of populist right alternatives. And they were doing very well back then. And I think in the past few years, particularly after 2017, we've seen, after, you know, Trump's election, we've seen you know, that tide has stopped to some extent, and it certainly looks far less insurgent. And actually, the great irony is, a lot of this emanates from the crisis of capitalism of the 2008 financial crisis, but also to some extent individual domestic political crises and a lack of faith in politicians. The answers, though, were decisively responded to by the far right in those countries, and they unfortunately were far better at communicating the responses than the left were. But I think actually they've been exposed, you know, the centre-right as well. You know, look at France, and hopefully us in a few weeks, and a number of countries across the world. It's been proven, it's been shown now, that the centre-right and capitalism don't have the answers to the problems of 2008. And, you know, I'm glad that the tide is sort of starting to shift. towards socialist alternatives.
We're coming towards the end of the podcast now. It's been great to have you on again, Nathan. It's been a great conversation, fascinating conversation.
Thank you, likewise.
And I would like to just ask you one final question. Today, the winner of the Comedy Wildlife Photography Awards 2019 has been announced. So I'd like to ask you, what's the funniest thing that's ever happened to you with an animal?
Okay, I've now got an answer. I wasn't expecting that as a question, to be honest, Will. But I fell into a pond full of tadpoles when I was quite young. Which is a great shame. So I don't know. Are they too small to count as a proper?
No. I think they can count. Yeah, if you.
It wasn't very deep though. Luckily, so I'm I can retell the tale.
Yeah, and look at it not as a traumatic incident. Hopefully.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being on the podcast. You're more than welcome to come on again any other time.
Thank you very much, Will. Thank you for having me.
It's been great to have you. If you would like to subscribe to the podcast, you can do so on iTunes, you can do so on Spotify and YouTube. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can follow us at Debated Podcast. If you'd like to email us, you can email us thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.